So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardwar. Our regular co-host, Sherlyn Lowe, is off for vacation this week, so be sure to send her well wishes. This week, we'll be diving into the analog pocket with James True. And also, Dan Cooper will be joining me to talk about news and other fun stuff. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget Podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. That's always super helpful. And you can drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. We typically do a live stream Thursdays around 10 a.m. Eastern, so join us for that. We do Q&As, we have fun times with the chat. Just heads up, we won't be doing one or an episode during the week of Christmas, but we will have something right before New Year's to preview CES. Let's move on to our first segment, which is all about the analog pocket. And joining me to talk about that is our editor at large, James True. Hey, James, how's it going?
How's it going, Devendra? Thanks for having me on. I'm pretty excited to talk about this. So, good to be here.
I know. I know you're excited because I also know you're our resident like retro portable gaming nerd. Like you were just all up in there. You're always up with your... is it Lynx is what you're...
So Lynx is... That's the thing I went all in on. I did 15-year-old me a solid, and then once I owned enough money, I just bought the entire thing. I barely play it, but I own it. So
I remember... I see like you occasionally showing off your carts and everything, and I just think like, man, I remember hearing about the Lynx in the early 90s. It seemed fine, but it also made me think like, this guy just loves his portable gaming. Let's talk about the analog pocket. What is this thing and what makes it so different from all the other like retro portable gaming systems we've been seeing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question because I think what a lot of people don't realize, I mean, you see a lot of these sort of retro gaming machines, and the most typical thing when you get like a handheld, it's either going to be some sort of retro Pi in a case, or it's going to be one of these sort of, if you go on Amazon and you just search for retro gaming handheld, you're going to get a bunch come up. Like there's brands like Anbernic, which are, no one's ever heard of, but they're kind of one of the bigger names in this space. And they just kind of do mm-hmm. this, they're all software emulation, right? So you've got the RetroPie, RetroArch, and all the Libretto stuff. And they just put all those together. And then you sort of play the games through that, right? What this does is they're very different. It's called FPGA, which is field programming gate arrays.
Arrays.
And it's basically, as I understand it, it's basically a chip that you can configure to represent or present itself as old or other systems, if that makes sense. So it can reconfigure itself. You get these things called cores, and you load the core into it, and it suddenly it's this machine, and then you can load another core, and it's suddenly it's that machine. But what that means is it presents itself to the game, and this is the important thing here, is the physical cartridge that you do need to put into the thing. And for all the cartridge knows is it's inside an original Game Boy. Or
sure,
the original
it has no clue like what it's plugged into, yeah.
Right, but the key difference there is that you do have to play with original games. So you need the physical cartridge to play it. So for a lot of people, that's a bit of a turn off, I think, because you either need to already have the games like I do, or head down to your local retro store and you're going to spend a bunch of cash because retro games have sort of reached a stable price, but they're not cheap.
Yeah.
So that's in a nutshell, that's what it is. It's basically the most authentic way to play retro games, retro handheld games, in a portable that you can do right now. So it's as if a Game Boy was made in 2021.
I kind of love it. Like I love. So I've pre-ordered one. I don't think I'm going to be playing many of these games. And also, I have this thing about like especially 8-bit games. Like I was there, guys. Okay, most of those NES games, especially most of the Game Boy games, they weren't good. I don't want to play them again. But there were certain experiences that I would totally be down for, especially like Game Boy Advance titles. Something like Final Fantasy Tactics Advance. It has not been re-released in a good way, I think. So this would be the only good way to play it. And to quickly like just to hone in on the FPGA thing, we've been hearing about FPGA chips for so long. And the idea, right, is that they could be fully reprogrammed to essentially copy those old platforms. And that means it's not doing software emulation. And that is a big deal, because emulation is what kills the experience of older games, right? If you have a Switch and you go back and play those Super NES titles or like the Genesis titles and stuff, and especially the Nintendo 64 games that just hit the Switch Online platform, the emulation on those things can be wonky. Zelda, Ocarina of Time looks completely different on the Switch because of the way the software is trying to like pretend to be a Nintendo 64. The key here is like, at the core level, at the CPU level, you could just like make a thing that is essentially replicating the chip in those older consoles. So what you have here is like a completely accurate gameplay experience, right? Like, have you noticed any differences, James?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. So I believe, was it who did the review for the PlayStation Mini? It was either you or
that was
or
me. And, that was
yeah,
me.
Because that is a really good example of this, because you mentioned two things there: Switch for the NES titles, and I'm talking about the PlayStation Mini. Now, both of those are official products made by those exact companies that made those games, but they've offered a sort of somewhat subpar experience, in particularly in Sony's case. Well, I mean, it's maybe not subpar, but it really was just a box with an emulator that you can do on many other things, right? You're just paying money for the fact it looks like an old PlayStation. But for me, what the problem really sort of occurs is that these things stack up. So the very core of software emulation is often something like Libretto and things like this. And then you have RetroArch on top of it. And then you have Emulation Station on top of that. So you've got these three layers of open source software. And then the hardware you're playing it on, which could be literally anything, could be your phone, could be your desktop, could be, any one of these semi-dedicated handhelds. And there's just so none of these things were made together. So they're all, you know, you've got these layers of abstraction, and you're getting further away. And so you can have configuration glitches, and, it's very well known that certain emulators are better for X and then others are better for Y. But do I want to change the emulator every time I'm loading up? No, I don't. You know, I want to just turn it on. So what you get with this is, it's a bit like trying to run Mac OS on a Windows machine. You can do it, but why would you ever want to? And it'll be functional, but it's not as good as if everything's vertically integrated. And I think that, to me, is really the key here. It really is a vertically integrated machine. Everything runs. Everything in this pocket was designed and built by the same company. So, of course, everything is highly tuned. And I know they're really paying attention. For example, I bought a really shady 108 games in one Game Boy Advance thing, right? Yeah. I figured, like, screw it. I'll just, like, get this thing and I'll see what it does. And it actually didn't work in the pocket. Now, I contacted them, but it worked in an original Game Boy Advance. So I contacted them and they were like, can you link it to us? We're going to buy it and they're going to take it apart and figure out why it doesn't work. And then they're going to make it work. And they did that with something else. Mickey Mouse on a Game Gear was one of the games I tested. And that crops in a weird way, which I guess is probably something to do with the Master System / Game Gear tierness. And when I told them about it, they said, actually, yes, we know about that. We've already implemented a fix. So they can actually, at a per game level, do these sort of things, and their whole shtick is authenticity. So, you know, I'm not trying to sort of, you know, sing too much of their praises, right? Because, you know, there are a lot of people in this thing. It is a premium item. It does cost $220. It's a lot more than if you're buying something from Amazon. You can pick up something, you know, a bit shady, but it's going to be like $60 sort of thing. So it's over double that. But you are paying for a beautifully integrated thing that just is from top to bottom is just a really coherent system.
Gotcha. And one thing worth mentioning too, it's not just the FPGA stuff. It's like the screen on this thing sounds incredible, because it is a small screen. It's a portable screen, but it's still a higher resolution than those other systems, like any of the older systems. But they implemented things to make it look like the imperfections of the original systems? Is that the thing?
Well, that's their messaging. They're always like, we replicated these screens' quirks and all, and it's really hard to unpick exactly what they mean, because you could argue that, oh, the FPGA is replicating the whole system, so any of those quirks, but I don't think it works like that, because any of the quirks could have been at the sort of circuit board level or sort of radio interference. I don't know. There are things that won't happen in the FPGA. But what they did do is, for example, the resolution is exactly 10 times what it is on the original Game Boy and the original Game Gear. So everything right from off there, you're set up perfectly just for a 10-time scale. It's 615 PPI, which is kind of crazy. That's like...
Too many right? PPs.
It is too many. It's like such a nerdy stat. But it's way above like the top iPhone. iPhone 13 is about in the 400, low 400s, I think. So they're able to sort of really dial it in like this. You know, there's just those sort of things that really sort of add to it. And that vertical integration I was talking about earlier, there's no mismatch between... these things. Have you played much on stuff like RetroPie or RetroArch and things like
that? A little bit. Like I've never fully gone in on any of those devices just because I haven't been fully satisfied with the emulation. But the minute like I saw your preview and I saw this thing, and we also know like Analog has been doing, they've been doing a lot of devices like this too. Like they have produced FPGA driven consoles as well. And people like them. They're very expensive, but people like them and they work properly. And I'm at the point where I'm like, you know what? Yeah, give me some nice hardware I can hold. I do have a pile of old games somewhere, especially Game Boy Advance titles. So it's like, yeah, I want to bring those back. I want to go to game stores and pick up some titles again. My question for you, James, who is this thing actually for? Is this thing for like a new younger gamer who wants to feel those older games in their like pristine way? Or is it for people like us who grew up with these things and can't let go?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. So if someone was saying to me, I want to buy a retro gaming thing, I want it to be portable, you know, and what would you recommend me? And I don't know if I would definitely off the bat recommend them this. It depends on who I'm speaking to. But if it's someone that just wants to dive into Tetris and maybe some of the old like Castlevanias and things like that, I feel like there are other ways that if you're just going to be semi-casual about it, this is maybe not the way to go, because I feel like this is hardcore enthusiasts for sure. People that are purists about like their whole experience, like someone who wants, you know, the best headphones and really good, you know, this, someone that really appreciates that sort of fine grain detail, definitely going for that. Younger gamers, I think, why not? If you've sort of picked up some older titles somewhere and you've enjoyed them and you really want to get into it, I think 100%. I definitely feel that there's a threshold you need to be above in terms of your care levels. Because this thing doesn't do anything else. It's not a media player. It doesn't have a touch screen. It doesn't have Wi-Fi. There's no like extra stuff. If you look at all these sort of Anbernic, the retro ones I was telling you about, they are hardcore specs. They're like, we've got quad core and it does all this, and they're just throwing all this. This is none of that. This isn't about the stat war. This is just pure. It's just a purity, I guess, it is the sort of word for it. So I feel like it's, you know, maybe people sort of that were there the first time around and are pretty into their games. This is the sort of one to go for them. But I would definitely say try out retro gaming handhelds first, because just to see if you're going to put it down after a couple of weeks, right?
This thing, it's a commitment. You can't easily return it, I think. Like, it's one of those things.
But you can't easily buy it.
You can't easily buy it, because the pre-order waves are going into 2023, from what I see on their website.
Already, which is ridiculous. Yeah. I'm hoping that's just a temporary thing, that while they're sort of overwhelmed with this sort of wave of orders. But 2023 already, if you want to pre-order this thing, or not pre-order, just straight order at this point.
It's also, it is selling for $220, which is, that's a pretty penny. That's $20 more than they were originally aiming for because of like the supply chain impact. Again, the global chip shortage strikes again, kind of like getting us at these things. Just real quick, James, like how does this thing feel? You've held portable gaming systems for so long. Does it feel durable? Do the buttons feel clicky enough? Like, did they get everything right in your experience?
Yeah, for the actual pocket itself, I think it feels great. It feels exactly like what, if I spent $220 on something, this is what I want it to feel like. It's got a sort of Scandinavian-y design, that's sort of matte black and or white if you want to get it in that, just one little pop of color. But The buttons feel pretty good. I'm not a huge fan of the shoulder buttons. Aren't quite, they're a little spongy. But unless you're getting really heavily into the Game Boy Advance stuff, then you're probably not going to be too worried about that. But they're also, I mean, they're totally fine. It's just, it's the only sort of nitpick really is on those. The D-pad's fine. It plays better than the original Game Boy, which isn't necessarily saying much, but you know.
Yeah, that's not much, yeah.
It doesn't have the air in it. You know, you can't, there's no crease. You can't like squish it. And I've got another one. There is definitely, you can, if you sort of give it a pinch, you'll feel it sort of breathe in, and you know, and there's obviously a lot of, there's a big vacuum inside of it. So in terms of hardware, this is definitely their strong point. It's absolutely delightful, and it's a talking point. People will see it and they'll ask you. I recently, when I was reviewing it, I took it away, went on a weekend away with some friends, and we're like up in the mountains, beautiful countryside, but everyone's playing this thing because they've seen it on the table and everyone's just sort of naturally drawn to it. And everyone, no one, you don't need to explain it to anyone because it's literally just a Game Boy that they were playing 25 years ago or whatever it is. So in terms of hardware, definitely good. Mm-hmm.
Is it an all metal case or is it plastic and stuff too?
You know, when you get those brushed plastics and you're like, it's not cold like metal. So I guess this is me saying that I don't know. It's definitely plastic on the back. And they've done a pretty good job on the front. It wouldn't bother me either way, if you know what I mean. It's got a nice matte finish. It's definitely a really good looking bit of kit, for sure.
It looks good. It reminds me of like classic Sony hardware too, where it's like, I just want to hold that. I just want to like hold and touch this piece of kit because it looks really cool. Does it feel safe in like your jeans pocket and stuff?
So I wouldn't do that because if I'd spent $220 on this thing, I've already got like there's a very minor line on it. It's not a scratch, but you know when you get those matte surfaces and somehow you've just maybe scuffed it a little bit. It's not a scratch, but I had to Photoshop it out of my photos. So have a look when my review goes live tomorrow. That you can sort of see it. But weirdly, they sell an additional hard case. But it's the weirdest thing because this is so well designed and so attractive, but the hard case is just transparent plastic and it has these two sort of clips that you have to like quite pressure in to it's a weird thing because everything else is so well done and it's functional, but you're kind of, once you've taken it out of that, you have this empty two halves that you have to put somewhere. And I don't know, I was less taken. And the dock as well, which means you can feed it into the TV, it's great. But when you seat the pocket in it, it's not locked in. It's just got a gentle sort of, you have to push it and it will teeter. You're not going to do that because you have to play with a controller. But just from a basic design perspective, I'm surprised. I thought it might have got it a little nice and tight and like the old iPhone docks or iPod docks where it's sort of locked in there. It just had a little bit of wiggle, which
I can see that. How does it look on the TV? Because I know like usually the like analog to digital push also introduces like a whole new set of like artifacts and stuff for gaming.
Yeah. Now the bigger issue really is that you're playing a game that was designed for like what is it, 160 by 144,
right.
And you're watching it on like I've got on a 4K TV and it's like it outputs the 1080. So you've got this thing's doing 1080 and then my TV is scaling it up or whatever it is. So I really don't think that's your issue. Your issue is the fact that everything is going to look a bit pixelated when you watch it on such a huge TV. Although I've had it on the projector I've got here, which is 120 inch, and I'm playing Mario Kart and it was great. So it is pixelated, but it was still so much fun.
That is a wild future we're living in where you can play Mario Kart. Is it the Game Boy Advance one?
Yeah, Super Circuit.
Super Circuit on a 120-inch projector screen. That's also the size of my projector screen. I try not to like say that because it's like when I talk about playing Halo, I'm like, guys, Halo looks big. Halo big on my on my setup right now.
It's overwhelming.
I can't imagine doing that with a Game Boy game. Man.
Well, I showed you, I think, a screenshot of I actually had the Game Boy camera in because it works with all those things as well. It doesn't matter what the accessory is. If it worked on a Game Boy, it will work on the Pocket. And I put the Game Boy camera in, which when I bought it secondhand just for this review, and it still had photos on it. So the battery was still like someone else's photos.
Wow.
But through the dock, you can put it out obviously into the TV and you have it come up. And it's an awful camera. It's terrible, but it's kind of bonkers. No one would have thought 30 years ago, 25 years ago, whatever it is, that this Game Boy camera would be piping up onto, you know, an ultra short throw 120-inch projector.
So, amazing. So amazing. This is kind of the future we're living in. Like, hey, climate change is going to destroy us all. The virus is everywhere, but we got our Game Boys back, baby.
Right.
It's great.
Here's me in 4-bit webcam, whatever it is. I don't know. Like, don't correct me how many bits it is. I didn't look it up, but, you know, it's not many.
It's like pre-VGA. It is like very, very bad resolution.
This is really, really bad.
Thank you so much, James, for diving into all this with us. Would love to chat with you more about all of your microphone stuff down the line. So, James, where can we find your work on the internet? We've got you in Engadget, but where else can people find you?
I mean, that's a really good question. I do a bit of production for a podcast called True Spies, which is pretty good. It's hosted by Vanessa Kirby. It's all about spies. So I do that in my... So whenever
James, how have you not told me about this before? What?
Have I not told you this? I'm sure I've...
You've not... First of all, I'm in love with Vanessa Kirby. I'm in love with spies. What are you talking about here?
So it's actually run by the New York Spy Museum as well. So it's in your hometown. Huh. So check that out.
Former hometown. But okay, cool.
Oh, sorry.
Cool.
Yes, I forget that you're down in Atlanta now. So that's kind of the main thing. Everything else is work in progress.
Very cool. Thank you. And you're on Twitter. It's true.
I realize that was probably your original question. So it's true.
Whatever, man.
It's true on Twitter, which is ITSTREW, and on Instagram. Don't follow me on Instagram, but if you wanted to, that's true.
All right. Thank you so much, James. Let's move on to some other news. And joining me to talk about that is our senior editor, Dan Cooper. Hello, Dan.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hello. It's always fun to chat. When Sherlyn is away, Dan can play. I think that's how it goes, right?
That is pretty much how it goes, yes. I mean, it's a one-to-one swap. I mean, it's seamless. There's almost no difference between the two of us in any regard.
I can't tell. If I call you Sherlyn during this episode, I'm sorry. But we've got a bunch of news to dive into. Specifically, I want to shout out a really cool investigative feature from Jess Condit at Engadget called How a VR Startup Took the Money and Ran to the Metaverse. And this is a feature that's been in the works for several years now. It's actually been, I believe it was started by Nick Summers, who used to work at Engadget. It's a long-running piece about Diedrich Reed, a guy who created this company called MetaWorld, but also has created a bunch of other companies, and it's all been kind of a fraud. So it's a really interesting story to look into now that Metaverse is the hype word of the year, I think. So be sure to check out the piece, and we will be chatting with Jess about this towards the end of this episode. So tune in for that. So there's really not too much news this week, but one thing I want to point out is that I was in New York last week, if you heard last week's episode, to check out a Dell preview event where they showed off a bunch of stuff, but some of the coolest stuff are these concept devices, and we've written up a few of them. Sherlyn was really taken with the Concept Pari, which is this really cool thing. Like, imagine you have a monitor with a webcam at the top. And what if you could take that webcam off? What if it was a portable device that you could just plug anywhere on the screen? What would that mean for video chatting? What would that mean for, like, collaboration with people? The idea from Dell is that basically it would help you bring the camera down to eye level, so you're actually having a face-to-face conversation with somebody on Zoom rather than an extreme camera angle like I'm having with Dan right now. So I'm wondering, like, Dan, would a removable webcam, like, help your work situation right now because of how we're talking at this point?
I mean, you seem to take great issue with my webcam angle. I mean, my laptop is on a stand, so it's nicely elevated.
In general, for photography and video, low camera angles, not so great unless you're dropping an album cover. So that's the main thing. But would you find this thing useful?
Yeah, I would. I think the big issue really is that, you know, when a laptop's on a desk, when you look like me, especially, you're always going to be shooting up at the least flattering angle. I mean, you know, Huawei, obviously they, as a sort of security measure, put their webcams in a kind of pop-up key inside the laptop deck keyboard. And so essentially it is the least flattering angle you could possibly get, sort of. So basically you lead with your double or triple chins, and then everything else is just window dressing. So the ability to kind of move the webcam up a couple of inches. I mean, hell, it would be great to do video calls from, like, the MySpace angle, specifically. But I do think that there needs to be a revolution in terms of where webcams go, principally because they're not fit in terms of how they're designed now. They're just not fit. I mean, what fit for really how we live these days? It would be lovely if you could change it, you know, and obviously the idea that you could attach it to the display so that it is sort of at your perfect eye level. I love. That's obviously, the risk the risk of having it detachable is that you lose it.
You lose it. There could be issues. I mean, that it means there's a limited battery life, and there are other things to think about. But I think you bring up a great point, Dan. Like, we're relying so much on our webcams now. We are waiting for some sort of like great innovation in this space. And I think what's really cool about this too is that, you know, when we were talking to Dell and this thing, Concept Perry, it's just a concept. It's not a shipping product yet. But the idea is that you could potentially have more than one of these. If you look at our video of this thing, Sherlyn has a Concept Perry on like an arm that's pointing down. And I can imagine when we're producing the show, you know, sometimes we want to show off gadgets and stuff. So if you had one camera on your monitor looking, you know, straight at eye level and another on a mount somewhere on your desk so you can actually show off devices or something on the table, that would be pretty cool, like juggling multiple cameras. I think given the way GoPros have kind of shifted the way people capture action, you know, footage on the go, we don't quite have something as nimble on the webcam front. Sure, you could use a GoPro as a webcam. That seems like a really expensive solution to solving your webcam woes. Have you heard about the Opal, Dan? The Opal C1, which is the $300 camera that a lot of people have been talking about lately, too?
Oh, is this the super fancy one?
The super fancy one, like yes. Fast Company, Jared Newman at Fast Company wrote up this thing called, the article is called, "Would You Pay $300 to Look Better on Zoom?" The Opal C1 is a camera with the 4K Sony image sensor. That's the one that Dell also has in their current 4K camera. But the Opal also has like good microphones, AI processing to make your image look better. For $300, like, sure. I think a lot of people would do that because right now what people are doing is if you have an old DSLR or an old mirrorless around, you mount it to your desk and you do some cable magic and software magic and you turn that into webcam. And that is something like I'm halfway through that process because I have almost all the things I need except the proper lens to get this distance. But that would be the best way to get a webcam, to get video footage for video calls. Not everybody can do that. That's a lot of work. I don't know. Have you considered doing that, Dan?
Do you know what? I looked at, because we about a year or year and a half ago, we put out a tutorial on yep. how to do that very thing. Yep. And I looked at it and thought, that's too much work.
Too hard.
I can't be bothered.
It's too hard. You look at that guide, I think for techie people, sure. You're like, oh yeah, sure. I'm going to get a desk mount. I'm going to get a battery that plugs into the wall to give my camera unlimited juice time. I'm going to get like a short lens. Like, you got to get a lot of stuff. You can't really travel with it. The Opal and most webcams, the joy of those things is that you can move it around. You just, it's one device. You could travel with it. Yeah. So I don't know. The Dell Concept Perry seems really cool. And hopefully it ends up being like a shipping thing of some kind. I don't know what's going to happen with this. Like, would you buy one, Dan? And what would be your price threshold on this thing?
Do you know what? If I was video conferencing every single day.
Yeah.
Given that it's an accessory, and I'm always loath to spend a huge amount of money on accessories because, you know, it's that thing of you lose it when you change computers. I would say, you know, $199, $200 is probably sure. sort of where I would go. But, mm-hmm. you know, it would need to be that sort of one, I buy it and that's my solution for
that's your solution.
Several years.
And a webcam, yeah, a webcam should last you like 5 years, I think. Like, there's a reason we haven't really seen this tech change much because the sensors haven't changed much. Like the Sony 4K sensor, that was like the biggest new leap for a while. But even then, people don't need, you don't need 4K on your webcam. What you need is like,
no, you really don't.
Light and also, capture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, most platforms compress the hell out of the feed anyway. So it's not as if, unless you're streaming, which I would say is a different use case. If you're streaming, do not buy a webcam for your kind of your single solution. When you're streaming, you buy a streaming setup.
Or you do, you know? The DSLR.
Yeah.
The good thing about 4K sensor is that you can like crop in a little. So if you're in a cluttered room, if you can't like find the right spot, then at least you can crop in and still get like a decent 1080p image. Anyway, that thing seems cool. Dell also showed off a Concept Luna laptop, which it just looks like a laptop. But I think what's really interesting is what's inside of it. They basically rearranged the hardware so that it's more repairable and it's easier to like recycle when you're done using it too. So they say it has 10 times fewer screws, a deep cycle battery, bio-based circuits. I'm still unclear what that means. I think it's just like more, you know, there's flax fiber in some of the PCBs, just a lot of things here that can, I think you can throw it away and not have to worry about like weird metals going into your bin. Any thoughts on the stand? Because I know you also checked out that modular laptop, right?
I was going to say, yeah. This has been an area of interest for me for a long while. And I have to, I'm fairly sure that when they started talking about bio-based materials, they just watched a lot of Star Trek Voyager and got carried away. But I mean, Dell's always, of the big manufacturers, Dell and Lenovo and HP as well, they've always been better than a lot of the other manufacturers. But certainly, I think, you know, Framework, who this year released the sort of the almost fully modular repairable laptop, you know, it's only a couple of screws to get into it. I would consider myself to be a sort of terrified novice when it comes to taking stuff apart. And, you know, they said, feel free. This should be so easy that even you, Dan, can't mess this up. And I was able, and the thing is, not only was it, is it designed to not be intimidating and easy, but it's also really quick. I was able to change the keyboard unit in 2.5 minutes.
Great.
And about 50 seconds of that was me struggling because I didn't realize the screws were captive. And so therefore I was trying to pull
you
it out.
You were like, you kept screwing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are those, I feel like removing things on laptops, the big thing is like people strip screws all the time. Are they using like better screw sizes to make it easier to actually use a normal screwdriver and stuff?
Yeah, they are. I think, I want to say there's only two different screw types and they, and most of them are like a standard size. Don't ask me what it is off the top of my head. That I think is the key discussion about repairability that lots of people forget is that it's not about, is it repairable? It's, is it repairable for the general consumer? This is something that annoyed me when Apple said they'd start releasing aftermarket or, you know, sort of official spare parts for the iPhone. And they were making a big song and dance about it. But also, I don't think people would necessarily feel comfortable pulling that display. You know, novice users would feel comfortable pulling the display off. So with the Dell, I mean, I would say this is where the industry needs to be going now in terms of making sure this stuff runs for a long while. If Dell can do this and they can do it well, I mean, it does look as if they've had to sort of rethink where the components go, put them all in a more logical place, and certainly make more room for that big beefy battery, because that is a big battery.
That's a big battery.
That is a really big battery.
A lot of these companies have, especially Dell, has optimized to make things cheaper to build, you know, not necessarily for to get back in there and repair things easily. So maybe this could have an effect on price down the line. But you know what? We are still in the middle of the global chip shortage, and it means bad things. It means especially you'll probably have to be using your hardware for a very long time. So, hey, if you're feeling like your computer's slowing down and you have something that you can actually plug more RAM into, now's a good time to do that, because you'll get more life out of your machine. This may be the way we have to live for, you know, for the foreseeable future too. Like, sure, and we're going to talk more about this in the future. But you know, chip companies are still struggling to produce supply. More foundries are being built, but it's going to be like 3 to 5 years before we can actually see the fruits of that labor. So, hey, folks, love your hardware. Take care of your hardware, because you're going to be stuck with it for a while. And when you need to upgrade, you'll either have a hard time finding things in stock or, you know, end up paying a lot more for it. So the idea of something like Concept Luna, I think, is pretty cool. It's pretty cool to have like something that's more repairable and more recyclable. Any further thoughts, Dan? Like, I know you've been thinking about this stuff for a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I would say, I think Framework deserves a big chunk of credit purely for pushing the conversation that way. It was going that way. But I think the guy, Nirav, the founder, basically said, you know, he's not intending to try and conquer the PC market. It's essentially, he's out there at the very fringe building a device that then will force everyone else to reconsider what they're doing. And I think the fact that Dell are now doing this sort of speaks to the fact that the conversation is changing. So I'm looking forward to, you know, 2 or 3 years down the line when we're not throwing away, when we're not throwing away all of the laptop components that we, you know, there's lots of stuff in a laptop that you're, you know, when you throw away your old version or you recycle the old version, there's plenty of stuff in there that's not, you're not getting an upgrade on, you know? Once you've got your 4K display or even an HD display, for most uses, that's fine. You don't need to replace it until you burn it out. Same with things like the I/O and the speakers, stuff like that. It's just waste. It's needless waste. So just eliminate that.
That's my take. I'm right there with you. And I think we could all use something that's a little more repairable. Moving on to another story, too. Just quickly, I want to mention that we saw that Apple had removed mentions of its controversial CSAM material, or its like CSAM approach. And that's stuff around child sexual abuse material. We talked about a couple of months ago that they were going to start, they were going to enable a feature that would scan your iCloud photo libraries for things, I believe, like things related or known known material within CSAM databases that could be related to child sexual abuse. And it seems kind of useful, and Trillin and I dove into this. It also seems like it could be a huge privacy overreach, and a lot of security experts kind of took issue with this when Apple talked about it. They have not said they're going to stop working on this, but the weird thing is that they have taken all removal of CSAM, all removal of like scanning your photos and stuff from their website. So I don't know. We don't know what's happening. Yeah.
Do you know what? I will say it seems like one of those instances where Apple is probably doing the right thing in terms of building the technology. And I think it's an unwritten rule or an unspoken sort of truth, maybe is a better way of saying it. It's an unspoken truth that all tech companies that have cloud platforms will have human moderators doing spot checks and audits. The idea that you know, you can upload anything to the cloud and it is, and no one ever will be able to access it or see it, is a bit of a fallacy. And so I think the idea of automating some of that, or maybe just reducing the intrusion on most regular users, is probably well-intentioned. But I think for obvious reasons, when you're talking about something so serious like this, and if you're glib about it, and to a certain extent, you know, whenever we hear Silicon Valley in general talking about, oh, we can automate it with AI, it'll be fine, we'll train a model and all will be well. And I think we've learned over the last decade that that approach does not necessarily work well. So I'm glad that I'm sure there's going to be more consideration put to this. And I'm sure it will come back eventually. And I think as long as that's a lot less opaque in terms of the conversation than Apple normally is, then I think we can have a mature conversation about it. But
yeah, I'll note, in September, Apple said that they would be delaying the rollout of its CSAM detection tools indefinitely, too. So we kind of knew they would be holding off on this. I think removing that language from the website is just like a thing to, you know, cause people to freak out less. But yeah, hopefully when the stuff does end up coming, like, they're in touch with security advocates too, because I feel like that's the big thing. There's a lot of potential for this technology to be overused. And I want to point out a piece on Engadget. Carissa Bell, frequent guest on the podcast here, wrote up a piece in August called Why Apple's Child Safety Updates Are So Controversial. It's worth a read to see like what the big deal is, because I do think on the face of it, hey, stopping child pornography, stopping the sharing of it is a good thing. But she talks about like why there could be downsides to this method for doing so. So give that a read as well.
Can we not call it child pornography though?
We could call it. I think CSAM is like, yeah.
CSAM is better because there's the kids don't consent. So like,
In other Apple news too, if you're using macOS Monterey, they have finally enabled SharePlay, which is the feature that can let you, you know, share movies and music with your friends and, you know, join together with friends to watch stuff. I've not tested this out in a working fashion yet. I've previewed Monterey quite a bit, So I'm looking forward to seeing how this works. Is this something you would actually use, Dan? Like, it is a cool idea, but I don't know how much people dig it. Yeah.
Do you know what? It's something that during the sort of the worst parts of lockdown last year, one of my best friends would buy stand-up gigs, sort of on-demand live stand-up gigs.
Uh-huh. And this sounds like a very Dan Cooper thing. Yeah, you're completely. Just like, give me the rush of going to a comedy club and not knowing if this person's going to be funny. Please.
But what we were doing was we were watching it. We were streaming it sort of to our TVs. And then we had Zoom open beside us with the volume turned down because of all the sync issues. But the idea there was so we could sort of enjoy the idea of sharing that experience.
That's cool. That's cool.
So if that process can be automated, but I think there's loads of content restrictions. So I think
there are.
It's only D Plus and TV Plus right now that actually allow it. So I don't think, you know, the Go Faster Stripe or the Dice platforms that we were using, unless they're going to sort of suddenly get the budget to integrate this sort of stuff, it's not going to really work for everyone until it can apply to every platform that's out there. Unless you really love Disney Plus shows. You know, I'm sure people do.
Yeah, I remember when Trillin was testing this too, she had trouble watching Ted Lasso with Matt Smith. And Ted Lasso is a show on both of our regions. But for some reason, like sharing that show, even though it exists on Apple's platform in the UK and in the US, watching that together with somebody across a region was a problem. You know, there's a lot of things to see here. It'd be nice if this stuff was completely unrestricted, but I also understand if the media companies were just like, no, what are you doing? Like you're giving away our stuff. They're just so used to locking everything down, but I'm hoping this feature ends up working out. Let's move on to what we've been working on. Dan, anything you want to shout out on your end?
Yes, indeed. So this morning, a piece of mine went up discussing Arrival's new electric car. Now, Arrival was founded by one of the co-founders of Yota, if your memories go back that far.
No, there's a lot of names going on here. So what is Yota?
Yota was a dual screen phone back in the day that was a thing. And it had an e-ink display on the back. So you could do your Kindle book reading, your book reading, article reading, anything that you wanted a low power display for. You sort of turned off the main display, flipped it over, and then you could do stuff with the low power display. It was quite cool and quite clever, but I don't necessarily think it was a big hit. But yeah, Denis, I want to say Svetlov, but please don't test my pronunciation of that. Then went and founded a company called Arrival. And they have been working, I think, for the last 5 or 6 years. And they're based in the UK. They've got facilities that they're building in the US as well. And their idea is to build large EVs. So there's a bus they're working on and a van. And the van has been picked up by UPS. And that's going to be there. I think UPS have already guaranteed an order for 10,000 UPS trucks. And the thing that they unveiled this morning, which I went to see on Tuesday, is their car. Now, rather than it being an EV for all of us, it's essentially designed to be the EV for rideshare drivers. So it's a taxi, more or less. And the idea is that it's very small. It's very light. It uses a sort of woven composite. It's not plastic, but it's sort of a woven poly something composite panel. So it's very light. And all of the space is essentially given over to the passenger cabin. So Uber drivers can poodle around cities, do trips to the airport and back. And it's very efficient. It's very light. And the idea is that eventually, you know, they'll be able to sell it cheaper than, or at least cost equal to the sort of vehicles that Uber drivers buy right now. And so I went to look at the alpha prototype, which I couldn't drive it around, but I got to sit in it and look at it. And it's a very cool, very utilitarian piece of tech. It's cooler than it's. I think I wrote in the story, it looks really uncool. It's sort of like
It looks like 80s sci-fi. It looks like they took that and was just like, you know, let's just round off all these edges. Let's make everything a little flat. Yeah.
Do you know what? There is that. There is a little bit of kind of sci-fi 80s styling, but also in the same way that, like, you know, work boots are cool because they're sort of anti-cool. I think this has that very similar vibe where it's very practical, very utilitarian, but also quite humane. There's some lovely details, you know, the all glass roof, really comfortable seats. There's so much space. Like, you wouldn't believe it. It's, you can't really tell, but it's really tall. It's sort of got the same sort of height as a Land Rover Discovery. It's even got the same. It looks very much like a Discovery, like a shrunken Discovery from the back. Someone called it a Cyber Twingo in the comments, which I think says it all.
I can see that. Yeah. It reminds me, the height of it almost reminds me of like the new Nissan yellow cabs that New York cab drivers started using. And the cool thing about those is that you just walk in, and it's like, it's not like you're scooting down to get into a car. You just kind of walk in, and then they have the glass roof too. So you're seeing all of New York. So I like that. I am testing cars myself, especially like family cars. I'm looking for like high-tech family cars for myself and also to write about. So one thing I've noticed is, man, I hate it when there's no sunroof or moonroof. I've started to hate it because these cars are getting so big. If you have nothing above you, it just feels like you're in a coffin. Like, you have no natural light, really. It's just, it's a really weird, restrictive thing. So this is a nice feature. And it looks like this thing has a lot of cargo space.
Not a lot of cargo space, weirdly enough. It's all passenger space. With this version, at the very least, there's only room for sort of two large and two small suitcases.
But even then,
they were saying, fundamentally, it might just be that we make the seats sort of pull forward a bit so that you can sort of sacrifice some of the leg room to make the cargo space bigger. But I have to say, it's so comfortable to sit inside. Like, you sit in that rear seat and you don't feel like you're in a car. You feel like you're sat on a park bench with all the room in the world. You know,
that's a sign of a good cab. And I feel like people in cities without cabs don't understand like what that vibe is like. But I appreciated like getting one of those good yellow cabs, like when I could, in New York. This is really cool, Dan. And what are you driving at home these days?
So I don't think there is an equivalent in the US, but I drive a Toyota Auris, which is it's one down from a Prius. They've just renamed it or denamed it back to the Corolla, which is what it was before.
I don't know
whether the Corolla in the US is exactly the same, but it's, because, you know, like, even when it's the same name, the US version is normally four times the size and about half the fuel economy.
That's how it goes. Yeah.
But you've got a RAV4, haven't you?
I have a RAV4. I have the 2017 RAV4 Hybrid, which is a really good car, but I am looking for something a little bigger. I found, like, for trips and stuff, like, basically, we did a beach trip this year where it was just me, my wife, and my daughter, and like all the beach gear that we needed. And we were driving it to my parents' house because they have a Honda Pilot, so it's a bigger car. We were all going to drive together. I had to stuff the RAV4 like to the brim. I had to have like beach chairs and stuff on the front seat because my wife usually sits in the back with my daughter just to, like, keep her calm for an hour. The trunk was completely full. Front seat was like packed. I had like, just like, my passenger was like all the cargo next to me. I was like, this is not sustainable. Like, I want to be able to do nice long road trips at some point, and flying with the kid is not always great, especially with COVID still going around. But we're in an area where if I drive 5 hours, I'm on a Florida beach, you know? So it's like, okay, I want to take more advantage of that. So having a bigger thing, I think, would be useful. But I think within the city, I'm really intrigued by this thing, Dan. So I hope this works out. And, you know, hopefully we're going to see like a big change in terms of transportation in general over the next 10 years. I know the Biden administration is making a big push for EVs in the US. I know in the UK and throughout Europe too, like, things are moving in a good direction. But I want it to be better.
It's slow. The progress is slow. And also, I think it's always worth mentioning that one of the big issues is always that public transport needs more infrastructure and funding, for the simple reason that if we just swap every sort of fossil fuel powered car for an electric powered car, that will not end climate change, because we'll still have all the issues with capacity, with the emissions necessary to power those vehicles, the emissions necessary to create those vehicles. So I think the next thing I'm going to buy is an e-bike. I've been keeping my eye out for a while, and I know that I don't want to sound like a smug when I say this, right?
That's just your normal tone, Dan.
Like, they're not for everybody, and they're certainly not for every single day. Like, if it's blowing a gale outside, of course you don't want to get out on your bike. But there are times and instances where an e-bike makes a hell of a lot of sense. You know, when it's dry, when it's a trip under, say, 2 or 3 miles. You know, when you're in a city the size of this one, if you want to get from one side of the city to the other, it's easier to do that on a straight line through the main part of town with the bike than it ever would be to go all the way around the ring road in a car.
Are you thinking an e-bike that looks like a normal bike, Dan, or like a cargo bike? Because the cargo bikes are the big things that I'm seeing people really get hyped on. I have friends in Boulder, Colorado, which is like a mecca of granola people and also like cool transportation. Like, they have bike lanes all around the city that don't even touch normal car traffic. So it's like, it's just beautiful. What do you think about doing a cargo bike or like a normal thing?
Do you know what? I've looked at cargo bikes, and the price of a cargo bike is just so much. I mean, I think there's one I saw, which is, I think, French or Dutch, and it's got a very nice sort of cargo hold with a very small bench seats and straps, or seat belts, so I could put both of my kids in there and take them into town very easily. But it's about £4,500, which is almost double in the US.
Yeah.
So that would be $8,000. That's I'm in journalism. Different story, but
it's usually people who are a little more affluent in the US who are going big on the cargo bike thing. But I've been testing one e-bike, which has a huge I don't know what the thing on the back where you could actually put cargo, like it has a big bench in the back and also has space for one child seat, and we've been using that during the summer, and that's been really interesting. So you know what, Dan, we will bring you back for a transportation chat, and also for me to make fun of the Hyperloop, because I know how much you're just such a big fan.
I think you're suggesting I cover Hyperloop uncritically, which I'm going to take issue with. But I think the whole point is it's a good idea. It's a good, like, just any conversation around about better public infrastructure is worth.
For sure.
Good discussion.
We can have that fight. We will have that fight in a future episode, because I don't know if it's better. But we will see. Thank you so much, Dan. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. And I feel like the main reason, the key reason we're bringing Dan onto this episode is that Succession Season 3 has finally ended, or has just ended. We are all still reeling from the finale. And we're going to talk a little bit about the show and why I think specifically the Engadget audience, too, should be watching. I think it's the best thing on TV right now. It also directly ties into technology in many ways. Like, it is all about on a broad level, the show is all about, the leader of a large media company, like a big Fox-like company, and his kids who are vying to take it over or have some position of power within it. And that's it. It's that royal drama of this very elite family and how they relate to other elite people and how they control politics and all sorts of things. Why should people watch Succession, Dan? Like, that's the thing we should start with. Yeah.
Why should people watch Succession? See, I feel very smug. I was a very early booster of Succession.
Yeah.
So I've been telling people to watch it.
We were there. We were right there. Yeah.
Why should you watch Succession? It's very good, I think. It is one of the – it's a very smart show, and it's a very fun show. And one of the things that I love about it is that it is a drama written principally by a group of British sitcom writers. And so whenever – you never go more than like 3 minutes without a joke. And so it's tremendously funny. It's tremendously dark. It is so much fun to watch. But then there are moments like in the season finale that's just happened where something that happens that's completely organic and in retrospect makes a measure of sense, but it's still an utter shock when it actually happens, you know?
Absolutely. And you mentioned, so Succession is created by Jesse Armstrong, who has produced, you know, some, he has been a part of some of the best British like sitcoms out there. I'm thinking of like everything with like Mitchell and Webb, that Mitchell Webb look, the thick of it, and especially Peep Show, a show shot entirely in first person through the eyes of, you know, characters. That show is entirely on Hulu right now. It used to be something I had to like order. I had to get the DVDs or somehow acquire it. But now it's readily accessible. And Peep Show is a hilarious, hilarious thing. It is wild to me to see the creator of that show, which is a straight up comedy that maybe is occasionally dramatic, is now basically like spearheading one of the best dramas, taking a direct stab at like American excess and American culture too. Like it is fantastic. I think from the cast, Brian Cox, Kieran Culkin, Matthew McFadden. We were talking about this before the show, but Matthew McFadden is the strangest person to see cast as the like dopey Midwest guy who doesn't quite belong with the elites. Because if you've been watching movies, a movie or TV, certainly British like stuff over the last like 20 years, you'd recognize him as the lead of MI5. He was basically the British Jack Bauer to a certain extent.
Yep. He was the British Jack Bauer. He was the star of Ripper Street. So he was Did you get Ripper Street was on Amazon, I think.
It was on Amazon. I never checked it, but I did see that it seemed like, yeah, it was an interesting role for him. I also know him from Joe Wright's excellent Pride and Prejudice adaptation. And I love Joe Wright. And he's like Matthew McFadden's fantastic in that. Anyway, strong cast. This show treats swearing and like just like people using colorful language like an art form. And I think that's the big thing. Get past the pilot. Maybe give it like 3 episodes if you have not seen any of it, because I think the pilot in particular is really, really bleak. Like there's some bleak, like rich people privileged stuff happening there where it's like, oh man, I hate all these people and why would I watch anything about them? But you know, a couple episodes in, you're like, okay, now I'm on board. What's up?
It's to be really stupid. Do you remember Jamie Lannister at the very start of Game of Thrones, which I guess is the thing now that we can use as an example, because A, that show's ended, and B, everyone in the whole world pretty much watched Game of Thrones, whether they wanted to or not. And so you start with a character who's a two-dimensional villain and then isn't even humanized, but certainly you spend time with this character and the portrait of them fleshes out and keeps fleshing out. And you become invested in their journey, even if they are also a really bad person. And I think Succession is essentially a show about 20 Jamie Lannisters, because everyone has dirty fingers.
They have the most obscene, wealthy, disgusting. People. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, they are also, they are running a media conglomerate that is not doing good things. And certainly there is a moment in the third season, which I won't spoil, even though it happened several weeks ago, in which they make a deal with someone who is tremendously odious. And they essentially promise to put the whole weight of the conglomerate behind this utter expletive deleted. And they're very fine with the sort of the immorality of doing so.
Mm-hmm. But I will also say, that's season 3 brings in a lot more guests, like a few more guest stars. And specifically, I think Alexander Skarsgård, who appears in the season, is basically a cross between Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey. Like,
He's Daniel Ek. It's a cross between Zuckerberg and Daniel.
We don't really hear much about Ek over here. But okay. I hear that. Like, we don't hear the stories about like Ek's humanity or lack thereof over here. Ek is the head of Spotify. But Skarsgård plays this tech bro, basically a guy behind a big streaming technology company who is just like above humanity. He is almost like what's his face from Watchmen. Manhattan. He is sort of like, all these humans are beneath me. Everything going on in this world is like, I don't need to care about, but what I care about is, you know, building this giant empire. And his approach to it, his inhumanity, I think is just kind of fascinating to watch. And Skarsgård is the guy where it's like, yeah, we've seen him be vampires. We've seen him be like genuinely evil people. And this to me feels the most chilling because it's like I see reflections of the billionaire tech bros who are currently basically running our world now.
Did you notice also that as something that passed almost completely, I think, unnoticed and unremarked, is that he is this sort of emotionally unavailable, money-obsessed monster. But also, he does love a... Can we say the S word? Should I say poop post?
Sure.
He does love a shit post, that man. And, you know, there was lots of consternation when he started shit posting on Twitter. And I just wonder whether there are other slightly dodgy billionaires who also crave the appeal, the slightly parasocial appeal of people on Twitter.
He's a weird hybrid of like the worst of all the major tech bros right now. I think that's the main way to put it. Like he's a bit of Zuckerberg's like blank death stare. He's a bit of like Musk's like social tanking, like using social media to either tank or increase the value of their company based on a single post. It is absolutely wild. Anyway, people, I think the main takeaway here is watch Succession. If you are listening to this podcast, you should probably watch it. The people are terrible, but I think the core of the show is like how their awfulness, they'll basically never get to be happy. And I think there is some enjoyment in watching these like rich elites just basically suffer through life. Anyway, that's
also
what I
that's
find.
The synopsis for the Engadget podcast, right?
That's true. It's absolutely true. One other thing I want to mention real quick, and thanks to Mark Dell in the chat for bringing this up, because I forgot to even think about this. But one thing that dropped last week was The Matrix Awakens, which was an Unreal Engine 5 tech demo. And I just want to shout this out real quick because this thing looks incredible. Did you take a look at any of this footage, Dan?
I haven't yet.
Okay. It's currently a PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X exclusive to show off like what Unreal Engine 5 can do on those platforms. But you can also see, you could see the full video in like 4K 60fps on YouTube right now. It features character models of Keanu Reeves and Carrie-Anne Moss that look, I wouldn't say exactly human-like, but certainly like CG render level, like what you'd imagine a CG rendered character would look like 5 years ago. It's doing that in real time. It has a big highway chase sequence that basically looks exactly like the Matrix Reloaded chase, except it's happening in real time. You can play it, and it looks like, according to a lot of folks like who've been working on that, it's actually even more more accurate in terms of like car crashes and whatnot compared to the way they shot Matrix Reloaded, where they didn't even have the technology to like accurately simulate car crashes and whatnot. So this thing is really cool. If you have a next generation console, I think it's worth checking out. At the very least, hit play on this on YouTube, on your TV, and just like take a look at how far we have come. And this thing just kind of floored me. I'll be talking more about this not next week because we're not having a show next week, but we will be talking about this during the next podcast, where we'll certainly talk about The Matrix Resurrections, the next movie in the series. And I'm very excited to talk about that. So stay tuned for all of that. Anything else you want to mention, Dan, in terms of what you've been watching or this Matrix thing?
Do you know what? I will say Unreal Engine, if we're not declaring it already, Unreal Engine is eating cinema in the next sort of 5 years. I mean, I did a story about Rebellion in the UK building their own version of the ILM Stagecraft platform. We now have, I think, Star Trek Discovery is now doing virtual sets using Unreal Engine. Please don't fact check me on that. I need to do a check. But obviously, ILM has used it for all of the Disney Plus shows to a certain extent. It's all using Unreal Engine. They've got all of the assets and everything else. I think it's not going to be long before Unreal Engine is cinema and cinema is Unreal Engine. I think that's going to be a thing that happens.
We'll be keeping an eye on that. Mark Dell also points out the Unreal 5 demo also works on Xbox Series S. I have not seen what the footage looks like on that, but honestly, the Xbox Series S is basically comparable to the Xbox One X from several years ago. So yeah, sure, it should do a decent job. It probably won't get all the nice graphical flourishes. So anyway, check that out and tune in for our next episode when we finally dive into the new Matrix and all of that fun stuff.
Thanks for joining us, folks. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find me online at Devendra. You can find Dan Cooper online at Daniel W. Cooper, I believe. And James True is at It's True. That's ITSTREW. And of course, Sherlyn is still at Sherlyn Lowe, and you can go bother her during her vacation. You can email us at podcasts@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Stay tuned for our chat with Jessica Condit about her piece on Metaworld. It's a great investigative piece, and I really think it's worth hearing what Jess has to say about it. We're out, folks. We don't really get to do too many investigative features very often here at Engadget, but this week, Jessica Condit, our senior editor, basically put together this piece about a VR company or a metaverse company that's been kind of a scam. The article is called How a VR Startup Took the Money and Ran to the Metaverse. And Jessica Condit is joining me right now. How's it going, Jess?
Hey, it's going all right. I'm not getting scammed today, so not that I know.
Don't get scammed.
So it's
a good
please,
day. Listeners, don't get scammed. Jess, this story, as I hear it, has been in the works for years. So can you give me like high-level description of what it's really about? And trace back to like when this is all started for you.
Yeah. So this is, first of all, I want to say like Aaron Souporis was a huge like part of this story. This was not just me like on my own doing this. And then Nick Summers, a former Engadget senior editor,
Yes,
we love Nick. And so we got to pull his name back and throw it on the article too, because we all actually interacted with this developer, Diedrich Reed, in, 2016? This was 5 years ago? Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I know, that time doesn't exist. What?
I know. Like, what was that? I guess there was life 5 years ago, and this is what I was doing. So we had just kind of met with some of these VR and MMO developers. Like, Improbable has Spatial OS, this technology that allows developers to create massive worlds in VR. And this developer, Diedrich Reed, was creating something using Spatial OS. He was creating this VR MMO simulation, and it was supposed to be just like huge and have a ton of features and allow people to really live in a beautiful landscape, interact with people, eat, you know, around a campfire, stuff like that.
Right. He's pitching a Second Life, but in VR, it sounds like.
In VR, which is a feat. Mm-hmm. That's a big promise already. Yeah.
And certainly in 2016, so to give some context here, right, 2016 is when the Oculus Rift launched, it's when the HTC Vive launched, and people started to see like, hey, consumer VR is a thing, right? So I figured that's why you guys were also interested in talking with this dude.
Absolutely. This was the heyday of like, okay, is VR going to take off? What does a world in VR look like? What is a social setting? What is an MMO? What can we do here? You know, first person, Second Life situation, like that's kind of the vibe. This was a cool developer selling something that looked pretty cool. But it quickly took a turn. Just as we talked with him more, we realized he didn't really have a lot to back up the things he was saying. It seemed like some of his promises were far too grand to actually be viable. And we just a few red flags. So we kind of backed off from covering what he was doing because it didn't seem like he was actually going to be able to deliver what he was saying.
Right.
So, but from that, we were all in this Discord server for Metaworld, which is the world that Diedrich was selling. And we got to watch as basically Diedrich just kind of abandoned that community and people just stuck around talking about how they felt scammed by him, how they had requested
refunds. Paid something, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. These people bought in. He was selling land, basically. He was selling like areas of this VR world, even though it was still in early access. There wasn't an actual product yet.
Right.
So this is why he was able to do this. And these people, they say they never saw an actual meta world. They were actually going to be asked to build it themselves. This was Diedrich's plan, was to have the community pay him and then have that same community actually do the work developing the game, and then also hold jobs in that world to keep the blockchain, the cryptocurrency, alive, right, in this world. So it fell apart pretty quickly. These people were really upset, and they were sticking around in this server that Diedrich had abandoned. So Aaron and I, over the years, were just kind of watching, like, wow, these people really, like, yeah, he definitely just kind of left this server, this community.
Do we have a sense of, like, how much money he raised with that first community?
It's in the thousands. He had 2,000 people who bought like land titles, at least, that we know of. But it's hard to pin down, right, exactly how much. Yeah, and if he did actually invest that money into cryptocurrency at the time, I mean, he could have actually made a pretty significant return. That was the time when that could have happened. So yeah, either way, a lot of people asked for refunds and no one got one. And then this year, a new Metalworld Discord server popped up, and it's Diedrich Reed again selling the same world, but this time with NFTs attached to it. Like, he's selling NFT land. So we saw him pop up again. We saw him being active on Clubhouse and people joining the Discord. He started selling stuff again. And so, yeah. Aaron and I were just like, all right, it's time to figure out what's actually going on here. You know, is he selling something? Because if he's selling what he's promising, a 10,000 square mile VR world where you can, you know, interact with your friends, you can have a house, you can have a job, earn money on the blockchain. It's all a beautiful idea. But I also think it's just impossible, given all the tools that he has or doesn't have, honestly.
For sure. It seems like there are a lot of red flags here too, because this is one dude. I'm not aware of, like, what he has produced in the past, but it's not like he has a whole development studio behind him. Did you guys talk to anybody who had purchased stuff and was just like, why do this? Why did you trust this guy that he would actually be able to accomplish anything?
Right. So, I mean, I think people were excited about the project for the same reason we were in the beginning. It's a great idea. With this new technology that was coming out, like Spatial OS at the time, it was like, okay, is this possible? We were kind of asking ourselves, like, can this be a thing? And I think these customers, these early investors, were asking the same thing. They assumed that this guy knew what he was doing. And that's where it all comes from. But there was one person that we talked with, and this broke my heart. This person threw down a few hundred dollars into the first Metalworld, and they have disabilities. I mean, this was something that they were really looking forward to connect with people, to have a social life in VR. And they were pretty devastated when it came to light that Metalworld was not a real product, that they were never going to be able to actually go inside of it. And yeah, Diedrich spoke with these people often and directly through Discord. He likes to talk. I wish we could just play some of the interviews with him. He really likes to talk. Yeah.
It seems like, I don't know, stereotype of a con man, I guess. And you guys talked about in your article, when it came time to, like, show off imagery and footage and whatnot, he basically just took footage that already existed and, you know, clipped out the credits from people to prove that something was actually happening. But what was his response to you, like, as you guys start to dig into this? Because it seems like he's not really basing it on anything. Did he ever have a good explanation for what was happening?
So that was one of the most interesting parts of the most recent interview, because I've talked with him a few times over the years. But to really get this story done, Aaron and I both got on a call with him. I started the interview. And basically, I got him to repeat the story, repeat all the claims. He talked about Metalworld, what he was building. A lot of it still didn't add up. So I found a video. Aaron and I had both already double-checked these videos. He was stealing assets from other people and then rebranding them as his own. These were videos that had been uploaded months or years before, and he was just putting the Metalworld logo on them and saying, this is Metalworld, when it absolutely was not. So we already knew that was happening. So I just got him to say that, yes, one of these videos, like he said, yes, that's me actually building something in Metaworld. And then I said, okay, well, it's actually not because this video was posted, you know, a year ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of bullshat in circles, uh-huh. you know, like it was just, that's not actually Metaworld. That's just what Unreal Engine can do. You know, all this stuff as if he didn't understand what we were talking about in the first place. His main response is recently he happens to be black, and this recent round of where he's selling Metaworld, he's focusing on people of color and black communities, especially on Clubhouse. He's using that as an in to kind of find a new audience, it feels like, for Metaworld. And so his response actually to a lot of my just criticism or a lot of my questions, it was just to say, oh, it's because I'm black and the VR industry is racist. You know, it's okay when white boy Joe Schmo does it, but it's not okay when I do it. And, you know, hey, we engaged with that. We were like, that's not what's happening. We asked these questions of anyone. But he did not respond to that well. And he was using race as kind of a way to keep those questions at bay, it felt like.
That's damn shame also, because like, yeah, we've always been fighting to see more people of color in the tech community. And yeah, it's a shame it's going like this. One thing I also noted in your piece is like there are these fake quotes from Engadget reporters, Wired reporters, and the quotes aren't good and also point to people who don't even work here, who have never worked here. So if you're going to fake a quote, at least try to put a name to somebody who may have worked here at one point. It just seems like everything here is built on a house of lies. So what is the big takeaway, Jess? Like, I want people to read your piece for sure, but at this point, have you heard anything from Reed? Is anything being done, you know, to protect the people that he's left behind, basically?
Yeah, so the response has been, I mean, pretty great. It seems like this has cut through some of the nonsense that he's been spewing. And like the Discord servers, there are still links to the article. People are posting this article like, hey, is this game? Oh, no, like this is not great. uh-huh. And so Diedrich is out. He's kind of disappeared from Discord once again. He has been on Clubhouse a few times, and it seems like people there are not buying what he's selling as much anymore, which is, I think, a good thing. Because he really doesn't have anything to sell, so it seems. But he did hit me up directly right after the article went live. And he just said, you are on the wrong side of history, period. And, you know, that wasn't a refutation of any of the facts that we brought to the article. So if he wants to engage with any of the facts that we've thrown down, happy to do it. But I do not think that's coming.
So it also seems like this is a classic story of people putting money on, you know, a crowdfunding campaign. I know he ran some Indiegogos as well. Any big takeaways here for, you know, listeners and readers? Like, we're going to see a lot of projects like these, certainly around NFTs as well. There are all these new mechanisms for people to try to fleece money from innocent consumers. Any big red flags here in terms of like what people should watch out for future projects like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Diedrich is a really good example of a modern day snake oil salesman. If it sounds too good to be true, just double check it. If it sounds like something you've never heard of before, take a look at that website. Does it look professional? Does it look like someone that can actually pull this off? Just do a little digging, do a little research. Uh-huh. If you get that weird feeling in your gut, walk away. Give it some time. If it's real, it'll still be there in a year and you can dive in then.
Yeah, that's true. It's not going anywhere. But also, like, yeah, folks, do your homework. Personally, like on the podcast, we've been saying, like, try to avoid crowdfunding campaigns in general, especially when it comes to things like hardware. Hardware is hard and it's very difficult for new people to just kind of jump in there and start building things. So, yeah, seems like yet another example of that. Jess, thank you so much for chatting with us. Where can people find you these days on the internet?
Yeah, I am on Twitter @JessCondit and on Instagram, Jess L. Condit. 2 T's.
Thank you so much.